Good evening. It's Sunday, November 21st, 2021. Coming up on tonight's news, all eyes are on Georgia as closing arguments in the case of the trio of men who took the life of Ahmaud Arbery are set to begin.
This is like literally a hunting situation. People do that to deer, and they did it to a human.
This, as protests take place across the country in response to Kyle Rittenhouse's acquittal in Wisconsin.
You know, this is unacceptable. Kyle Rittenhouse and this whole system of white supremacy is guilty.
As we're ramping up for another holiday season, some folks are reimagining the holidays from a critical race theory perspective.
And now when I sit down with my critical thinking kids and even critical thinking grandkids for Thanksgiving meal, it's all about thinking critically about our history and about maybe this pilgrimage out to the Western world wasn't as beautiful as we thought. It has created a lot of benefit for so many, and it's left and destroyed a ton of people in its wake. And so we all kind of live with sort of the ache of that.
And animal rights, climate, and healthy access advocates say plant-based meals are not only good for the planet and for animals, they're also the most inclusive way to go this holiday season.
Some people find it ironic that this day of, like, giving thanks for family and life also is a day for which 45 million turkeys are killed just to be eaten on Thanksgiving.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. Closing arguments in the case of the father, son, and neighbor who followed Ahmaud Arbery last February when he was out on a jog in a suburban Georgia neighborhood are set to begin tomorrow. Late last week, Travis McMichael described to lead prosecutor Linda Denikowski his decision to pull the trigger on Ahmaud Arbery while reading his notes.
You also could have stepped around the back of the truck and followed him in the path that way. Is that right?
Yes, but then he would have had an open, unrestricted run around the truck and into my open door, into my pickup truck, and took the truck.
So you're telling this jury that a man who has spent 5 minutes running away from you, you're now thinking is somehow going to want to continue to engage with you, someone with a shotgun, and your father, a man who's just said, stop or I'll blow your head off, by trying to get in their truck?
That's what it shows, yes, ma'am.
And you just pulled that trigger immediately?
No, I was struck, and we were face to face and being struck, and that's when I shot. He started striking, he was on me, he had a shirt or, you know, something to that point, and I had the gun.
Prosecutors have declined a plea deal, and all eyes are on Georgia as the two sides prepare to make their final arguments this week. Nick Harris is the drummer in the band Armed for Apocalypse. He's also a yoga instructor, an athlete, and a college student.
When this happened, my roommate, Anthony, is an African-American man from Georgia. And he's like, turn TV on. And I was like, oh, crap. Like, he told me, he showed me and all this, and I was weird, just blown away. And what he said that really, you know, resonated with me that day, he said, dude, they went like hunting. People do that to deer, and they did it to a human, you know? I was just like blown away watching this video, and that it took so long for anything to happen. People were passing it off, and I was like, this was any person, like almost any other color, this would not be a situation. But then running in Portland, I usually run between like 4 and 5 in the morning, right? So I was like, any headlights after that, I got really weary. For, I don't know, maybe like even a couple of months, I was really weary of running, and anytime the headlights would come, I would eye the car. I would dial the car, like whatever the car was, like if headlights are coming behind me and they passed me or by anything, because it was dark out, you know? So like, it made me afraid for sure. Absolutely. It made me super, super self-conscious about running at night or in the early morning. And it was, I don't know. And like now in Moraga, I'm not really as worried about that per se, but I noticed the looks. I noticed the steps to the right or to the side of the road. I notice the hey, how you doing? To the runner running past me that doesn't acknowledge me. It's okay. Like, I get it. And I've also learned, like, the passing part of it. Like, the passing with me is that, you know, I'm guessing people are like, oh, we must go to St. Mary's. Or, like, a lot of the times, like, I run to the grocery store and I have a backpack that says St. Mary's on it. You know, so it's like, it's like almost like my rite of passage for an African-American to be running in your neighborhood. You know what I mean?
Harris says his own intersectional identity and appearance as a tall black man informs the way he shows up in a world whether he's out running or on the road with his band.
I'm in a touring band that tours often, and we have California plates. So we're like with this big white van with a big white trailer, and you know, we are a big sore thumb on the road, and we have California plates in a lot of places. We get pulled over a lot. I have also been pulled over just, you know, I'm 42. I've been driving since I was 16, you know, so I've been pulled over a couple times. But I will say I have gotten tickets in life, but I've never had any kind of real situation where, like, I was afraid. Like, first off, let me just start with this. Like, when I was a kid, I would hear my mother constantly grilling my brother, older brother, like, you can pull over, or we do whatever they tell you. Just don't argue, don't be smart mouth, and whatever. She always, like, grilled and said, grill, always, always, always. So I always had those lessons from my mom. But
it's like it's a survival lesson, right? That's what she was trying to do with you.
We learned at a very young age on what you do when you get pulled over, how you interact with police officers. Pretty cut and dry. It was like little things like when you get pulled over, take the keys, turn the car off, take the keys out of the ignition, put the keys on the dashboard. And, you know, then it's like when you're driving, don't have your wallet in your back pocket or your bag or whatever. Always have your wallet, like, in the cup holder where it's easily accessible. So when, if you do get pulled over, you have your ID right there. You don't have to go fidgeting around. It's like, bam. So there's that. And then, like, the quick thing is, like, the second you get pulled over, like, instantly pull over. You know, like, where you can pull over safely, let the officer know that you have seen him or seen them and you are pulling over. And then the quick one, another one is, like, your hands are at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock on the steering wheel, and you do not move them until you're told to. So these are, like, these lessons that I learned. So I remember getting pulled over when I was 16 years old, driving to school, I was speeding. I just dropped all these lessons, and it was like I didn't get a ticket. And then it was like the conversation was really cool. And all I'm doing is I'm just disarming the police officer by showing the police officer that I am not a threat.
Well, Harris doesn't dispute that it's not fair that he has to be disproportionately more careful than white motorists, hikers, or runners. He says it's a way to de-escalate and hopefully walk away from a situation alive.
It sucks getting pulled over when you know you're just getting pulled over because you're black or you're BIPOC or whatever, because that's happened before too. The moral of the story and the whole reason why I would ever talk about this is just, it's the lessons that, like, not necessarily save you from the ticket, but it's the lessons that you can learn that save you from the next step of, like, okay, step out of the car. Oh, you got an ad, just step out of the car, or let me grab my wallet. Don't move your hands, but whatever it all is, you know, like getting a gun pulled on you, like, I wouldn't even know what to do. You know what I mean? Like, so all these little tricks are to prevent the next step.
In terms of what Harris would like police officers to take away, he says it's simple.
Like, not everyone's a criminal.
Harris says his own identity as a yogi, an athlete, an entrepreneur, a non-traditional aged college student, and a heavy metal musician underscores the fact that people are more nuanced than they seem sometimes. On August 25th of last year, Joseph Rosenbaum, Anthony Huber, and Gage Graskreutz were among the protesters in Kenosha showing up to support Jacob Black, who was paralyzed after being shot by police. Kyle Rittenhouse showed up with an assault rifle, claiming he was there to help protect property. Rittenhouse ended up shooting 3 people, injuring 1 and killing 2. On Friday, after 3 days of deliberation, a jury acquitted Kyle Rittenhouse from all charges. Michelle Chai is from RevCom. She says that Rittenhouse's acquittal symbolizes that the justice system in the country is completely broken.
This is unacceptable. Kyle Rittenhouse and this whole system of white supremacy is guilty. And, you know, what we just witnessed was a stamp of approval and green light for white supremacists, fascists, terror, and murder.
Were you surprised?
Yes and no. I mean, when you look at how the trial was unfolding, it was very likely that this is what was going to happen. But still, when you know that this was wrong and he is guilty and we know it, and when you look at the larger context, you know, of in which this was taking place, it is still a punch to the gut, you know? It is like the legitimizing of white supremacist vigilantes carrying out murder, you know, again, given a green light and a stamp of approval.
One of the things Rittenhouse's attorney said is he's not a white supremacist. He's not linked to a particular organization. So let's say that he's not linked to a particular organization. Why is he a white supremacist in your view?
In the larger context, and even like the people that raised, how much was it, like $2 million to bail him out? The people that celebrated with him after he came out of jail, these Proud Boys, you know, throwing up white power symbols and pictures with them, you know, like we all saw this. It's like more clear when, you know, he's throwing up these white supremacist symbols and acted in what at that point, you know, was being called for from Donald Trump, the white supremacist in office at the time, right? And unleashing, you know, to go after people that were in the streets calling for justice and actually standing up for Black lives. You know, like it's very clear what is actually, what was at play, right? And now, you know, the people that celebrate his acquittal, the people that, you know, chant his name, the people that see him as a hero are these Proud Boys, these, you know, the same people that stormed the Capitol on January 6th. You know, these are all, you know, fascists, you know, and these are all people that are, you know, preparing for a one-sided civil war, a one-sided slaughter, you know. This is the who they see what Kyle Rittenhouse did and are itching themselves to do the same kind of thing.
And as you started by saying, in some way it sends a green light that this is quote-unquote okay, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So we have the acquittal of Rittenhouse. We have the other men who killed a Black man running in their neighborhood on trial right now. Pretty soon, former Officer Kim Potter's trial will come about for the case in Minneapolis. We saw some progress after George Floyd's really tragic death that was, you know, broadcasted, and we all saw it. The life he squeezed out of him underneath the knee of former Officer Derek Chauvin. And some people had hope, but now here we are again. Where's your hope level today, and what do we need to do to go forward?
We saw the potential for revolution in what you're describing, right? Last year, when people rose up in the streets after seeing George Floyd, you know, get murdered, after seeing Breonna Taylor, all these names, all these people, and where, you know, people here in this country, but all over the world, rose up and actually demanded, you know, justice for these people, right? And out of that, what happened, right? Like one cop, just one cop that got, you know, convicted for this murder, you know. But we have to go way further, you know, not just convicting all these cops, because there, since then, and during the trial of just Derek Chauvin, there was a number of people that were murdered, you know, that have not gotten justice, right? And that was just during his trial, like, not even talking about what has happened up to this point. We need revolution, nothing less, to actually put an end to this white supremacist system that gave birth to these white supremacists like Kyle Rittenhouse, like Donald Trump. You know, these are all people, you know, that, you know, this, when you're talking about a system that was founded on slavery and genocide, you know, there is no reforming that system. This is what the system is built to do, you know? And so that's why we're getting organized for revolution. And I feel like that hope that we all saw last year, that we all felt last year in being together in the streets, we have to take that even further, you know, not feel defeated because of what just happened, but actually like come together, the power that we do have in coming together and actually being in the streets and, you know, taking this to where it needs to go, which is the liberation of all people.
That's Michelle Chai from RevCom.
You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota.
The East Bay community of Lafayette culminated its United Against Hate Week on Friday with a sunrise stroll around the Lafayette Reservoir. Jay Lifson says the pandemic gave the town a chance to reimagine its traditional community breakfast.
Every year, we have an annual community breakfast, Thanksgiving breakfast, just to get the community together, talking, just sharing a nice moment before the craziness of the holidays. Well, we've been unable to do that for the last 2 years. So I had a crazy idea. Hey, let's walk the reservoir instead. So here we are at the beautiful Lafayette Reservoir. And
why do you think it's important to connect this event to Stop the Hate?
Well, in my opinion, if you've been living under a rock for the last 400 years, you understand why we have to keep this message going.
The event brought together an intergenerational crowd to paint rocks, reflect on necessary change, to enliven diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging efforts within homes, traditions, and at a citywide policy level. My own daughters helped me cover the event while painting rocks for the BIPOC Rock Garden.
Painting a rock.
What's your name?
Espy.
Why is it important to paint a rock?
It's for the rock garden in Lafayette. It shows people respect that you care for people from, like, different backgrounds.
How early did you have to get up to get here this morning?
6 o'clock in the morning.
How was that?
Kind of challenging, but also fun.
Why is it important to stop the hate?
Because hate, it's the opposite of caring. And so it's important to stop hate so we can care for others and be kind.
Cool. And you are bicultural, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm half. So my mom was born in Wisconsin and my dad was born in El Salvador. So I'm like half, but it's fun to be half because you can still be two things.
Okay, anything else you want to say?
Just care for others and be kind.
Jennifer Wakeman is the chair for the DEIB Citywide Committee.
Talk about what the Rock Garden is and how it came to be in one location.
Yeah, so we had a local student who felt strongly about the Black Lives Matter movement. And he painted rocks and put them by the East Bay Regional Trail. And people kept moving his rocks or defacing his rocks, and he was really disheartened by it. And so he went to the city council and shared his experience, and the city council felt strongly about supporting his effort and his vision for DEI and decided to set a permanent area aside for a BIPOC rock garden at the Lafayette Community Center where his rocks were relocated to.
There's an annual, breakfast tradition this year is changing. We're doing a sunrise stroll. Why is it important to connect it to Stop the Hate?
Oh my gosh, because I think that the community DEIB committee's efforts, their whole intention is to make awareness and education part of the mainstream in Lafayette, and so that people always feel welcome and feel like they are part of a community that accepts you as you are.
And there's a larger narrative sometimes that people on this side of the tunnel from Orinda onwards don't care about diversity, and it doesn't matter in Lafayette. What do you want to say to that narrative?
That's untrue, that it does matter to people in our community, and though we have historically been white and affluent, that we still want to make space and make sure to recognize other groups of people, whatever their backgrounds, whatever their histories are, and welcome them into our community.
And lastly, what are some of the other efforts that you have coming up on a citywide level around DEIB work?
The biggest thing is that at the council meeting on November 22nd, the community DEIB committee will be going before council to lay out kind of a plan of intended work and to ask for funding. So it's really asking the city to make a serious stand about the work that the group is doing. They're asking for money, but they're also asking for the council to consistently use the lens of DEI as they make decisions throughout the city. So not just with regard to specifically DEI events, but also with regard to housing decisions and public safety decisions and decisions around the schools, really keeping that lens prominent.
Another resident told me what led her to get involved.
Janet Thomas, and I am painting a rock.
And how long have you been involved in the DEIB committee?
It's been about 7 months now, yes, and it evolved from the city's task force, which started after the George Floyd death when there was conversation around race equity and inclusion.
What did the George Floyd death mean to you personally, and how did that move you to get involved?
Well, actually, it wasn't just that one event, although it was a shocking reminder of the injustices that exist that we tend to gloss over or cover up. And It was so apparent, and the conversation started opening up, that this seemed like a time ripe to deal with some of these issues in all communities.
Pastor Dan Center called on the crowd to keep leaning toward inclusive change while reimagining the ways in which we celebrate holidays.
Obviously, Thanksgiving has changed a lot in our household. I don't know about your household, but I remember when I was 7 years old, I loved Thanksgiving at my uncle and aunt's house down in Carlsbad, California. And I loved just coming together around a table with family who was very diverse. I didn't think they were in our gene pool, but clearly they were. But it was all about the food and the consumption. And on the table was always a pilgrim and an Indian living in solidarity together. Because that's the story that I got told when I was younger, right? Well, that's changed. You know, we know our history much better now. And now when I sit down with my critical thinking kids and even critical thinking grandkids for Thanksgiving meal, it's all about thinking critically about our history and about maybe this pilgrimage out to the Western world wasn't as beautiful as we thought. It has created a lot of benefit for so many, and it's left and destroyed a ton of people in its wake. And so we all kind of live with sort of the ache of that in our bones, I think. And so we gather around the table now. We don't have a pilgrim and we don't have an Indian sitting on the table, but we're more aware of what it means to be responsible for the impact we have on each other and how we think about our collective life experience together. And I think that's partly what it means to be thankful these days, is to have this capacity to really be thoughtful about the way we build traditions that might reflect this new perspective.
Lafayette City Manager Nirup Srivasa says affordable housing is a key focus area for the town, in spite of some logistical challenges.
We've been able to maintain the beautiful hillsides, the wonderful ridge lines. At the same time, we've been able to grow our downtown and in a wonderful way and add up to our affordable housing stock. Because Lafayette is a community for everyone. General plan, our land use constitution says that Lafayette is a place for people of all ages, incomes, ethnicities. And being able to do that has been one of the most satisfying things. We still have a lot of work ahead.
Yeah. So there's a
lot of work ahead.
Yeah.
Especially with the high cost of housing these days. There's more to be done. But I think this community is committed to that, and I'm so proud.
Thank you so much for the thorough response. And what kind of, I'm curious, especially on the housing front, as I know many families are hanging on by a thread to keep their kids in the school district. What encouraging words can you offer to people, or what progress is already being made in that?
Well, the city of Lafayette for many years has had something called an inclusionary housing ordinance, which means that if you build a housing development in the downtown, 15% of those units have to be affordable. And over the years, we've been able to grow that every project on a project-by-project basis. So as a result, we have affordable units in all the new downtown developments that you see. And they're all integrated with the market-rate homes. So it's been a long process and a slow one, but I think it's a step in the right direction.
Do you think there's any chance that we'll ever rethink the 15% threshold and make more?
We would love to go more than that, but sometimes the state of, you know, housing is kind of regulated by the state of California. They consider that to be a constraint on development, because then market rate developers will not build. So it's a fine balance. I wish we could get... Oh, absolutely. I think we need more housing for the people who work in the downtown, for our teachers, for people, for young families. Absolutely.
So
it's getting there, and we don't have the money to give anymore.
Right.
It's not as if we're not a wealthy city government-wise, because we're a low property tax city. We only get 6 cents on the dollar of a property tax. Whereas places like Richmond get 22 cents to the dollar. So you know, it's not that we have money to give a developer to say add more affordable housing.
So we really need a developer to be, so like we would almost need, you need,
we need a nonprofit as well. We've had one nonprofit project that we approved with 46 very low income units for seniors. But, you know, they don't come by too often.
So, and in order for this to really make a dent in this, we probably need another nonprofit or a developer that has like a DEI kind of heart where they're thinking about this as a structural issue.
Yeah.
Do you have hope that that could happen?
Oh, I'm always hopeful.
Those are voices from the Lafayette Sunrise Stroll, culminating the town's United Against Hate celebration this Friday. Each year, the holiday season is traditionally a bleak time for turkeys and other animals who wind up as the main dish at many family gatherings. Katie Cantrell is with Better Food Foundation. She's also the founder of the Factory Farming Awareness Coalition. Cantrell says this is a great time to rethink traditions and replace meat with plant-based options.
Some people find it ironic that this day of like giving thanks for family and life also is a day for which 45 million turkeys are killed just to be eaten on Thanksgiving. But you know, it's also hard, like, there's a reason that in January people are so eager to make resolutions to eat healthier and to diet, which is that most people like overindulge on the holidays too. And that doesn't feel great either. You know, feeling like stuffed and sluggish. And so, you know, it's I think a fraught time for a lot of people. But you know, there are some ways to make even small changes that can be empowering and kind of help with all these things.
Let's talk about some of those.
You know, for people who are already interested in eating more plant-based foods, whether for health or for sustainability or for animals, you know, cooking and bringing delicious foods that people can try is a really great strategy. There's a lot of really simple substitutions that can be made to make most Thanksgiving foods plant-based. You know, obviously there's turkey and ham, but really most of the rest of the dishes are pretty plant forward already, you know, mashed potatoes and yams and green beans and stuffing, like they're already mostly plant-based. So things like just using vegan milks or butters instead, like there's really simple switches that can make them plant-based. And
Cantrell says not only are plant-based options good for you and for the planet, they're also more inclusive.
We've been encouraging people who aren't necessarily vegan themselves to make those switches in order to make sure that more people can eat the foods that they're making. So, you know, obviously people who are vegetarian and vegan would appreciate that, but also people who are lactose intolerant, who have egg allergies, who have religious restrictions. I mean, there's all kinds of different reasons that people might not want dishes that are full of, you know, milk and butter and eggs and beef stock and those sorts of things. And then also, you know, in terms of feeling better too, plant-based foods, you can get the same really delicious textures and flavors. It's really, you know, mostly about the seasoning in terms of how these dishes taste, but they're not as heavy when they're plant-based. They don't have all that cholesterol and saturated fat, so you can indulge and, you know, not feel quite as guilty.
We know that chickens are factory farmed. Is the same true for turkeys?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, turkeys, the vast majority of turkeys are factory farmed. So they are raised in incredibly unnatural conditions. And turkeys can't even mate normally. They can't physically mate anymore because they've been bred to be so artificially large and, you know, to have these really large breasts. So they actually, like, male turkeys can't even mount female turkeys anymore. They have to be artificially inseminated.
What kind of impact would it make if some people, like if people decided, okay, this Thanksgiving, we're going to not include turkey, we're going to try a plant-based option. What kind of impact would it make if some people, like if people decided, okay, this Thanksgiving, we're going to not include turkey, we're going to try a plant-based option?
Like voting, where, like, you know, if a million people suddenly make a change, then collectively they can really shift the market or, you know, the outcome of an election. So if demand for turkey drops a lot and demand for plant-based products increases a lot, then businesses take note of those trends.
That's Katie Cantrell with Better Food Foundation. And the weather. In the San Francisco Bay Area, clear tonight with lows in the upper 40s, sunny tomorrow with highs in the upper 60s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, partly cloudy tonight with highs in the lower 40s, mostly sunny tomorrow with highs in the upper 60s. That's it for this evening's news. Thanks to EA, who's at the controls, and to you, our listeners, for tuning in. I'm Sharon Sabota. It's been a pleasure to be with you this evening. Good evening.